Up next in Flexible Elements, host Per Joborg talks with Kyle Gilpin about his work with electropermanent magnets, which makes excellent connectors for modular robots as they're strong, small, solid state, and consume power only when connecting or disconnecting. From IT Conversations. Hi, this is Phil Windley, the executive producer of IT Conversations. Today I'm excited to bring you another program from Flexible Elements with Per Joborg.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media.
And now, here's our program from Flexible Elements.
So welcome to the Flexibility Envelope podcast. I'm here today with Kyle Gilpin. We're going to talk about self-disassembling robots, robot pebbles. And he's going to talk about the connectors and how they use them. And welcome, Kyle.
Thank you. Appreciate it. It's good to be here.
Yeah. So you use the connectors for many things, I understand.
Yeah, so we've developed a new electropermanent magnet connector. And when I say we, I mean myself, Ara Kanayan, who's also at MIT, and our advisor, Daniela Roos. Mm-hmm. And these connectors use the principle of electropermanent magnets. And by using these connectors, we've taken what used to be three components in most modular robotic systems, latching, power transfer, and communication, and combine them into one component. So the electropermanent magnets do all those things with a single device.
Yeah, that's really powerful because we have to shrink these things.
Yep.
What were the main challenges, do you think, that you had to overcome?
So one of the main challenges is how can we make these things really small and still be able to build them and use them in an efficient way? And so we put a lot of thought into how to design these connectors and how we can get as much functionality out of one piece as possible. And so there was a lot of thought put into what's the optimal design, how can we do things like power transfer. So most magnetic systems, when you have metals in the system, you think of the metal is just conducting. And if you think of a horseshoe magnet, you have a single horseshoe magnet and it's all electrically conductive. Mm-hmm. Our electropermanent magnet connectors look very much like a horseshoe magnet, but it's not conducting. Each pole is isolated from the other pole. So we can use the North Pole, for example, to pass positive voltage and the South Pole to be the ground in the system. Yeah. And so we put a lot of thought in things like that. So how can we isolate those poles to get more functionality out of one component?
Yeah. What kind of size are we talking about right now?
So the connectors themselves are about 6 millimeters across, about 4 millimeters wide, and about 3 millimeters tall.
Yeah. And the size is because this is what you could do right now. Do you see them shrinking with when you can go for more advanced technology as we start to make them commercially?
Yeah, so we've looked at shrinking these, and if you look at the scaling laws, we think that they will be able to scale down even further. One of the challenges is being able to manufacture them in that scale,
yeah,
winding the coil, gluing the pieces together.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be a challenge, but the actual theory behind it should scale well, and the power consumption should also scale well.
Yeah.
So with a typical electromagnet, you have very poor scaling because you need more and more current as you go down in scale, dissipates more and more heat over a smaller volume.
Yeah, and suddenly after a while you reach the end.
Suddenly you're creating a heater, and in our system, the beauty of it is that you only need to apply power to the electropermanent magnet when you're switching it on or switching it off.
Yeah.
So when it's in a static state, either attached to something or detached, there's no power consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really a great system because it's not sitting there burning power like an electromagnet would do.
And generating heat.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So when you turn on the power when you connect, and then when you disconnect, you also turn on the power, but in some form of reversed order, huh?
Exactly. So there's a coil that's wrapped around this electropermanent magnet, and we send current through that coil in one direction to energize the system, and then we can remove that current, and it stays latched.
Yeah.
And then if we send current in the opposite direction, we change the polarity of one of the magnetic materials in the structure, and it unlatches from whatever piece of ferromagnetic material is latched to, and once you remove current, it remains unlatched.
Yeah, yeah. And you also use this for communication. Is this they must use a complete different set of powers then, so communication doesn't interfere with gripping?
Correct. So you can only do one or the other at any particular moment in time,
mm-hmm.
but once it's latched, you can still use it to communicate, or once it's unlatched, you can still communicate with it.
Yeah,
you can't just simultaneously latch and communicate.
No, but the latching process, I guess, is very fast. Huh?
Yeah, so the latching process takes about 100 microseconds
mm-hmm.
to latch and or unlatch. The communication is done through a series of really short 1 microsecond pulses.
Mm-hmm.
So we send these short pulses, and when you have two of these electropermanent magnets facing each other,
mm-hmm.
they form an effective 1-to-1 isolation transformer.
Mm-hmm.
So you send a short pulse of current through one coil in one neighbor,
mm-hmm.
and that same pulse of current shows up in the opposing neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can detect that pulse in the opposing neighbor, and by going back and forth with this series of pulses, you can send information from one module in the system to its neighbor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Could you talk about the size of the whole pebble so we get a kind of a picture there?
Sure. So we've developed a system of what we're calling robotic pebbles, and these pebbles are 12-millimeter cubic modules. They have 4 of these electropermanent magnets inside of each module. The modules are formed by taking a flexible circuit board and wrapping that circuit board around a brass frame.
Mm-hmm.
And so that brass frame is a cube, and when we wrap the flex circuit around it, we form a cubic module, and the electropermanent magnets are mounted on the inside, and they protrude outward about 1 millimeter.
Yeah, yeah. Do they also use the radio communication and the magnets for aligning themselves when they latch on?
No, the electropermanent magnets don't employ their communication mechanism to affect alignment, but there's a natural alignment because the magnets are at a minimum energy state
yes.
when they're perfectly aligned. And
mm-hmm.
so if you have 2 modules sitting on the table next to each other and they're close enough, they can attract, which
mm-hmm.
is about 2.5 to 3 millimeters away,
mm-hmm.
which is 20% to 30% of the module size,
mm-hmm.
then as they attract naturally on the table, they'll kind of automatically snap into place so that they're well aligned.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because that's a major issue when we try to dock them to align them.
Sure.
Okay, that's interesting. Do you think that the size you choose was basically, I guess, to make it reasonably practical to produce? How hard will it be to shrink it further?
So there are certainly challenges in shrinking it further. We think as we go forward that we'll move to an integrated semiconductor process, some type of MEMS device,
mm-hmm.
where we're fabricating the whole module on one die or wafer,
mm-hmm.
and then we will cut up that wafer into a bunch of modules, and as we cut it, each one of the little sections we cut out is going to become a module, and so we'll be able to produce hundreds or maybe even thousands of these modules on one silicon wafer.
And then, of course, the size can be really, really small.
Exactly, huh? Yeah. And
yeah.
There's don't get me wrong, there's still a lot of challenges in
mm-hmm.
going forward. Even 3D fabrication is still a very open area of research, and so there's a lot of unanswered questions in terms of how we would actually go about fabrication.
Mm-hmm.
But I think to get another order of magnitude smaller, we'd have to go to a process like that. It just
yeah.
gets too hard
mm-hmm.
to assemble these by hand.
Yeah, yeah. So what kind of time frame are we talking about here? Are we talking about 5 years or 15 years or 25 years? Or
I think it's somewhere in the 5 to 7 year time frame that we could
mm-hmm.
have some prototypes that are at a much smaller scale.
Yeah, and then we're talking about, I guess, a number of millimeters, 1 millimeter, or even smaller than that.
Yeah, so yeah. the system we envision is a smart sand system.
Mm-hmm.
So we envision having sand-sized particles, maybe 1 millimeter, maybe
mm-hmm.
slightly smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that we're going for is you have a bag of these particles, and if you
mm-hmm.
want to build a form, an arbitrary shape,
mm-hmm.
you can have these modules in a bag, and they can communicate and bond with their neighbors. And you shake the bag around, and
mm-hmm.
as you're shaking the bag, the modules bond and communicate.
Stochastically, then.
Stochastically, exactly. And so the energy you're putting in the bag is what's causing them to align and bond.
Mm-hmm.
And they form a block. And then we can transmit some shape information into that block. So if we want a specific size wrench or a screwdriver, we can transmit that into the bag, and that shape is distributed in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And then the modules, when they've assembled, then start peeling off like a sculptor would sculpt a block
needed,
of stone.
Huh?
Yeah, so what isn't needed is removed, exactly.
Yeah.
And then once all those extra pieces are removed, then you can reach into the bag,
mm-hmm.
pull out your tool, brush off all the extra modules,
mm-hmm.
use the tool for whatever task you have.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you're done, the beauty of it is you open the bag, you drop the tool back in, it
just
disintegrates.
Back into it again.
Exactly, and you do it all
yeah.
over again.
So you're going to do it like Da Vinci said, how do you do these beautiful sculptures? It's easy. Just remove what's not
exactly.
supposed to be there.
You got it.
There is, of course, the question about cavities within a form.
Yep.
Have you done any work on that area where we when you do the stochastic pre-assembly, so to say, you leave holes in it to have holes. Because, of course, if there was an internal cavity, the parts could simply would have nowhere to go.
Yeah, so that's one of the challenges with this system, is it is more difficult to create internal cavities. It's much easier to create solid shapes.
Mm-hmm.
We have some ideas that aren't terribly well formed at this point about how we could go forward. And as we're doing that initial self-assembly step, leave cavities in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you have your final shape, those same cavities that you intentionally created as you were building it would still be there mm-hmm. after the disassembly process.
Yeah. And that's the time frame there. Is it also in the 5 to 10 years, 7 years?
I think that time frame is much shorter. So that's more of an algorithmic challenge and something that I think we could easily solve in the next 6 months to a year.
Very interesting. It's going to be very interesting because I think when you have come there, when you've managed that part, you have a complete system to do the static objects.
Yes.
That's also a question I have. A wrench is a static object. A hammer is a static object. But we might also want to assemble objects that have a dynamic part, maybe a hinge or somewhere that they need to move. They might need to move passively, like a door. They might need move actively, like a robotic arm.
Sure.
These parts are perfectly static, I guess. Have you had any thought on how to do units this size that could provide, for instance, expanding and contracting or angular changes?
Yes, so that's one of the things that we've thought about. My co-author, Ara, in particular, has developed another actuator based on this electropermanent magnet concept.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea behind that is he's created a wobble motor, which uses electropermanent magnets.
Mm-hmm.
So it's essentially like a very small stepper motor that
mm-hmm.
only consumes power when you're actually taking a step.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can envision having a module, and one face of the module has half of this electropermanent stepper motor on it.
Mm-hmm.
A neighboring module has the other half. So as these two modules come together, the two halves of the motor plug together very naturally,
mm-hmm.
and then two modules could then rotate relative to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, you can easily incorporate a hinge into the system.
Yeah.
And it's more than just a hinge. It's an actuated joint. So you can actually turn one module with respect to the other in a controlled fashion.
And from there on, you have to use the structure of the assembly to provide the motion capabilities
Correct.
You want.
Yeah.
That is very interesting.
Yeah, we're excited.
And what kind of time frame there again?
So I think that's another year to 2 year type
time
frame.
So it's a bit longer than the whole thing, but a bit shorter than the really small thing.
Yeah, I think that's definitely feasible, I think, in the next year. R is still working to develop this concept a little bit further, but it's coming along quite nicely. We're excited. Yeah.
Is this way of doing it, what we like to do is we like to build on each other's work and we like to reuse. Many of the planning algorithms for this stage where we have an assembled structure that we need to control, have you thought anything about how we're supposed to control the active part? So now we've had the stochastic pre-assembly, we've had the disassembly that brings out the object, and now we need to control the dynamic part of our object.
Sure. So in our system, we have a very efficient way for communicating with the modules.
Mm-hmm.
When we are sending messages to the modules, we never do any type of broadcast message.
Mm-hmm.
So each message in the system has a very specific destination, and it follows a very direct path to that destination.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're going to talk about dynamics, I think our system is advantageous because we can very efficiently communicate information into the system
mm-hmm.
so we don't get bogged down with a huge number of messages flowing everywhere in the system.
Yeah, because
so we can do this very efficiently.
Yeah, because if we are supposed to do any significant volume in our objects, we'll need a huge amount of units. And then, of course, if everybody talks at the same time, it's not going to work.
Yeah, it's really hard. Yeah.
Okay, we have this system. We might say we look 5 or 7 years in the future. We have the system that can form holes. It can form the object on top of that. It is dynamic. We can control it. What do you think will be the suitable first thing to start to do more practically for somebody to actually use? Any examples there that you like to mention as suitable?
So the big picture we imagine is a universal toolkit. So if you're a scientist stationed at the South Pole over winter and there's no plane flights in or out and you mm-hmm. need a tool, this is a great thing to have. So if you could have a bag of really the smart sand and you find you need something, you make it on the spot. It's like rapid prototyping taken to a new level.
Yeah, because of both of the fact that you can reuse the same material, you don't have to go and get more plastic. And it's also dynamic in another way. It's actively dynamic. So for the regular public, do you see any... I mean, it can be annoying if you have your stuff in one location and you need it in another location. It doesn't have to be the South Pole. Huh?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And like a lot of new technology, it'll take time for the price point to come down to a point where it's affordable to the public. And the modules are expensive right now.
What are we talking about?
So we're talking on the $200 to $300 range per module, but you also have to take into account these were all assembled by hand. So it's a lot of time that's invested in these.
So I guess when we talk about the price, these larger modules probably will never be sold, the research tools. So if we look at the smaller modules, could you say anything about the price there? Because that's basically what anybody will ever buy.
Huh? Yeah. I think it will still be an expensive proposition in the 5 to 10 year time frame. But I think it'll come down because we're talking about producing these on a silicon wafer. And so when you're producing in that type of scale, you can do it much more efficiently. Everything's identical. There's no manual labor involved. It's just fabricate the wafer, dice it up into a bunch of individual pieces, and then pour those into a bag, and that's your smart sand.
Yeah.
So per module, the price will certainly come down. But the other thing that has to be considered is that as the module size shrinks, you need a lot more modules to make a complete system.
Yeah, and that, I guess, your system could also have no problem with, would have no problem with the fact that it could have a scaffolding structure where the physical requirements of in the solution we're using is small. We could have lots of air in it, I guess. Because, so we wouldn't have a solid structure all the time, only solid when we actually need the strength of that.
Yes.
So that reduces the number of modules and it reduces the cost.
Yes, that is true.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing we've thought about is having different types of modules. So not every module would have to be the same size, right? You could have modules that are 8 times as big or some other multiple that fits nicely into this lattice structure.
Yeah, yeah.
Or you could consider having modules that have batteries in them. Mm-hmm. And the batteries, by definition, are going to be bigger than a grain of sand.
So
you could think of having these battery modules that have the same type of connectors as the other modules, but the other modules can bond to them and get power from this battery module.
Yes.
But then the system as a whole still retains a nice degree of flexibility because it still has small modules, so you can form very intricate shapes but have the battery at the center.
Yeah. These systems, as opposed to the self-reconfiguring systems, cannot generally reconfigure themselves. They have to go back to this stochastic step being in the bag.
Yep.
Do you see it as possible to, with these systems, build a kind of a metabolizer that could actually change the overall structure by, for instance, assemble in this stochastic step in our solution, we incorporate a little robotic arm built with the smart dust that could, for instance, move the cubes around in that fashion so that we could actually make it, so we could partly or wholly skip the stochastic step if we need that for our solution.
Yeah, I think that's definitely possible, although the advantage of the stochastic assembly is that it makes the module simpler. They don't have to worry about this precise alignment that you'd have to worry about with an arm.
Yeah,
so maybe instead of an arm in the system, you can think about what types of shapes are conducive to producing another shape. So you can think of a scaffolding, right? So you can produce some scaffolding, and that makes it more favorable for a module to fall into some particular position.
Yeah, yeah.
So once you've produced that scaffolding and used it to kind of direct your self-assembly in a certain way, then you can break down the scaffolding and you're left with the part you wanted to produce. So it's a more abstract type of arm in the sense that it's not directly actuated, it doesn't need precision, but you're still using the other modules to help direct your assembly in a particular manner.
No, this has been really interesting. Is there anything I've forgotten to ask you? Is there anything you'd like to say? We've talked about a lot of things, including price and the future of size and...
There's nothing that comes to mind. We're very excited about the system just because it is simple. We have a module with no moving parts. It's potentially scalable down to very small dimensions.
And also then cheap cost, I guess.
And cheap cost,
We didn't get a quote out of you for the smaller one's price. You said $200-$300 for the larger ones.
To be honest, I'm not sure. I'm not a semiconductor engineer, and so I don't have a lot of experience pricing those things out. I think it could come down into the probably at one extreme, $2. At the other extreme, maybe $10. I think somewhere in that neighborhood.
So the basic unit you'll most the customer would probably use the $2 units for the normal scaffolding, and then have some special units that, for instance, could display a color and be part of the skin and give you a nice texture or visual appeal. Maybe like a TV, but it's like a really small piece.
Yeah, definitely.
No, man, that's really interesting. I must thank you for being part of the podcast. And,
yeah, you're welcome.
I'll hope to talk to you in a few years again when you have more to report.
Thank you. This is fun. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a presentation from Flexible Elements with Per Joborg.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. The post-production audio engineer for this program was John Van Horn. Our website editor was Joel Cherney. The series producer is Joel Cherney.
This is Phil Wendley. I hope you'll join me next time for another great presentation from Flexible Elements with Per Joborg here on IT Conversations.